You're listening to a thoroughly good podcast made for the Women's Royal Army Corps Association, celebrating women who serve, a podcast series that spotlights, celebrates and honours the pioneering women who have served and are serving in the Army. My name is John Jacob. I'm a writer and a podcaster who normally spends most of his time listening to and writing about classical music. This series of podcasts about the women who have served and who are serving in the British Army is something of a grand expedition into the unknown, exploring a subject I have no first-hand experience of, armed with nothing but a notebook in which there is written a very long list of assumptions. In this survey of women who have served in the British Army, I find there's one question I keep coming back to when speaking to Army veterans, a question that seeks to gain an understanding of why people joined up in the first place. A lot of that comes from an assumption on my part. What is the motivation for joining up? Are people running away from something? What does the Army provide them with? Is the Army compensating for something? These questions are motivated by a strange appetite to understand what life was like back then in the run-up to and during the Second World War. The answers that arise tussle with the nostalgic perceptions decades of generational storytelling imbue and inflict. Grace Taylor, née Clark, was born in Ilford, Essex in 1924. Her mother died when Grace was 11 years old. Grace left domestic service at 16 to sign up and later, after training, joined the Royal Artillery where she worked in spotting and in the plotting room. Grace Taylor was one of 300,000 women who served in the ATS during the Second World War. In the interview that follows, Grace speaks with enviable clarity, spirit and warmth about her experiences 90 odd years on. And yet, Grace, like many other Army veterans, is self-effacing to a fault and humble about her contribution to the services. These are the kind of women who paved the way.
My mother died when I was 11, and my father remarried. And my stepmother, he married again shortly after, you know, a year after. And my stepmother didn't really want his three girls. So as soon as I was, well, before I was 14, I was put out into domestic service. My older sister was 2 years older than me. She was also put out in domestic service. So she only had my younger sister, who was then about four, to look after. But shortly after that, that sister that was four was brought up by aunts and uncles the rest of her life.
Can you give me a description of what domestic service was like then?
Domestic service, well, you had to live in, and you were a general skivvy. You had a half a day off a week, but the rest of the time you had to be up early in the morning to get all the cleaning done and the fires cleared out and fires relayed, and you had to work in the kitchen, and you also had to make the beds and do all the housework. And you started very early in the morning and you didn't finish till after dinner in the evening when you had to serve the dinner. So, you know, it was but you did that because you had your own room and you had somewhere to sleep. I had no home to go to, you see.
Where did you, where was your domestic service? Where did you work?
It was in Westcliff, near Southend. They were business people, yes. They were a Jewish family, actually. They were very good to me in a sense, but it was just that I was only a child. And when you've got to go and live with strangers and do all their work. They also had a young child that I was supposed to look after and do their meals and feed them. Well, I didn't know how to look after a child or how you fed them or anything. But somehow I got through it, but needless to say, I didn't stay all that long.
How long did you stay doing that for?
About a year. Probably even less than a year. But I was never out of work. You had to find a new job before you left the old one. I was never unemployed.
You speak very matter-of-factly about your stepmother not wanting you. Do you remember how that felt at the time?
Oh, yes, because, I mean, my mum, my real mum, she was lovely, she was beautiful, and she loved us, and she showed it. And I missed that with a stepmother. She didn't know how to put her arms around you or tell you she loved you like my mum did. My mum was beautiful. Unfortunately, she was only 35 when she died.
What did she die of?
Some sort of water infection, I believe. But she was only in hospital just over a week. My dad used to go and see her every day, of course. I mean, they were a lovely couple because we were a happy family. It was so sad and such a shock when she did die.
Did you have any warning that she was going to die?
Oh, no, definitely not. No, I was most surprised. As a matter of fact, on this particular day, or evening rather, my father was collecting us from an auntie that he'd left us with while he was at the hospital, you see, and we were walking along and had my sister one side and I was the other, and he was holding our hands. And I said, "Who's with Mum now, Dad?" So he said, "Nobody. She's died." And that was double.
So you did a couple of other jobs after domestic service.
Yeah.
And then how did you come to hear about the opportunity in the military service?
Well, one of the jobs that I, the last job actually that I took in Civvy Street was in Brentwood. And I was befriended with a young soldier who was in the Ordnance Corps. And I used to love dancing, ballroom dancing. And he used to meet me in and have dances, you know, at the dance in Brentwood. I had to walk there, of course. I didn't have any transport in those days.
How far did you have to walk?
It's part of a walk, of a mile. And he lived outside the other side of Brentwood, you know, where the barracks were, Orley Barracks. So we used to meet for the evenings. And, of course, he told me that they were posting him away. I'd known him for a few months. And he said that he was being posted away. And I was quite upset about it. He was my only boyfriend. And I don't know. Somehow I got it in my head that if I joined up, I might meet him. Well, I realise now how silly that was, but that's how my mind went at the time. So I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll join the army. But my nearest office for signing on was in Southend, and I had to go all that way back again on the bus.
How long did that take?
Oh, gosh. You ask me now, how long did it take to go from Brentwood to Southend on a bus? it's got to be a couple of hours, isn't it?
Wow. That is how committed you were.
That was a nearing recruiting office, you see. And if I wanted to join, you've got to do it, haven't you? I had to wait for me half a day off, you know, to go and do it. But
Did you tell anybody else at the time? You had to get a half a day off, but what were other people telling you when you said that you were going to do that?
Well, I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell anyone I was going to join up.
What would they have said?
Didn't tell me employer, because once you've signed on, you've got to wait for them to send for you. And that would have been an awful period, wouldn't it, when they knew that I was going to leave.
were they advertising for women to join, or was it something?
I remember, actually. There were always notices up, "Your country needs you," you know, everywhere. I don't know, really.
So did you think at the time...
There's a couple of weeks later, I had a letter from them telling me to report to Arborfield. No, it wasn't Arborfield. It was Leicester. Yes. I had to report in Leicester Barracks. Glen Parva, I think it was called. That was where I had to report, first of all, where you were issued with your uniforms and everything. Yeah.
Was there any point during that period of time when you, after you'd signed on, when you sort of thought, I'm doing something really quite unusual?
No, I was just looking forward to having a new life and having lots of company. You see, it's very lonely, really, when you're in service and you're the only staff. So I was quite looking forward to being with other girls, and I was excited. Like going on a long holiday for me, I thought at that time.
And presumably the opportunity to find a boyfriend.
Not straight away, no. Oh, my boyfriend, the one that was sent abroad, he went to Port Said in the Middle East. And he still wrote. Once I joined up, and I wrote to him and told him that I'd joined up, we still had letters to each other for some time, actually.
How did he? Do you recall how he reacted when you told him that you'd signed up?
I don't think he showed much reaction. In actual fact, it wasn't easy getting letters, and he didn't always get my letters straight away, of course. But the last letter I had from him, he said, I haven't heard from you for so long. I think you must have found someone else because you haven't written to me. He probably missed about three letters by that stage.
Had you found somebody else?
And he said, if you found yourself a new boyfriend, if I ever meet him, I'll tell him what a lucky guy he is.
Oh.
I always remember that being in that letter. But I never heard any more, and I didn't write any more. So that was the end of that relationship.
When you went to Leicester Barracks, when you joined up at Leicester Barracks, do you recall how you felt that day? I know that's such a tough question, but I'm...
Yes, well, there were several girls all arrived at the same time from all over the country. And you are then issued... It was a barracks. I'd never been to a barracks before. So we were given a barrack room with about 20 girls in. We had to go and collect our uniforms, our kit bags and our uniforms and gas masks and steel helmets and boots and gaiters and a dress uniform with khaki trousers, khaki lisle stockings, some underclothes like bra and knickers and some... There were some white knickers, and there was also some khaki ones with elastic round the legs. Oh, they were called passion killers. So when we got our kit bag, we had to ram all this stuff in the kit bag and carry it back to our barrack room and sort it all out. But then, of course, the time was taken in showing us how we should wear them and how we've got to clean our buttons and on our dress jackets and... We were taught how to march and how to salute, long way up, short way down, sort of, if you know what I'm talking about. That was your arm that went long way up and short way down.
You talk about discipline. So what I'm struck by is that there was a lot of discipline.
Oh, a lot of discipline, yes. You had to do as you were told and at the right time. Mustn't be late for anything. And
did that come as a shock?
No. No, not really. I mean, you've got to have discipline, haven't you, when there's a lot of you together and you've all got to do the same things. Yes.
Was it reassuring? I ask because there's a parallel between the discipline and the order and the process of domestic service where everybody is sort of contributing.
Oh, there's no comparison.
Okay.
No comparison, because you leave all that behind you. You're not going to be doing it again with a bit of luck. because I mean, you were taught that you all had to do the same. You all had to, what they called, barrack your bed. You all had to fold your blankets in a certain way and leave your beds looking in, tidy, exactly the same. Because you had to, if an NCO came in, that's non-commissioned officer, if they came in, you had to stand by your beds. And so you had to stand to attention while they spoke to you, while they spoke to the whole group that was in the room. Everything you did through the day was timed. You had to be up at a certain time, and you had to go and do your ablutions at a certain time, get yourself dressed and your bed made, and certain time to go for breakfast, and you all had to parade outside and be marched down to the dining room and queue up and collect your meal and go and sit down. And mind you, we were a jolly crowd. Once you got to know each other, you know, you could have a laugh and a joke when you weren't on duty.
How long did it take you before you felt settled in, do you think?
Oh, only a matter of days, really. Because, you know, you had to learn how to march. And we even had to march on with parades with the bands, with the army bands. And we did quite a lot of marching. So we were taught how to march, of course. You had to do the normal marching step and also the slow march. We were, in our days, we had to point our toe with every step. Point your toe and then put your foot down slowly. That was the slow march. But I loved doing it.
What did you love about it?
I like marching because, well, I like dancing. I like rhythm. You see? I enjoy rhythm. Yeah, I liked it all. You learn how to turn to the right and turn to the left and about turns, and you do it all to numbers. And of course, you always start off with your left foot, and it's all down to numbers. Yeah.
So this
funny,
is
when I look back on it now, it didn't seem, wasn't difficult at the time. Not to me, it wasn't. No.
Did you feel as though you'd made the right decision?
Oh yes, I never regretted it. I went in as a girl and came out as a woman. Yes.
What do you think changed you then? When you go in as a girl and come out as a woman, what did you learn?
It was a comradeship, I think, and having friends and being able to laugh and see the funny side of things. And when we used to travel about in the 1,500 weight lorries, we all used to start singing, and we used to sing descant, lots of all the old songs, you know. We hadn't a care in the world, really, when we were off duty. But we were very serious when we were on duty, because being in ACAC, it was heavy ACAC.
Anti-aircraft?
Yes.
Okay, so what did that mean that you were doing sort of day to day?
Once they had decided what we were best suited for, and they decided that I was going to be best suited to be in the Royal Artillery and be a gunner, you are then put into a battery, and my number was a 495 mixed heavy ACAC battery. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yes, it does.
When they say heavy ACAC, it was a big gun.
It sounds almost like music, I have to tell you.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Say it again, Grace.
They were the biggest guns, and they were gun sites all around the coast, across the country as well, of course. But I was mostly around the coast. The guns were called 3.7s, and there were three or four on each gun site. The guns were never moved. It was the battery of the troops that were moved. So that was when we were travelling about in the 1,500 weights and the 3-ton lorries.
You speak so matter-of-factly about all of this. And I hope you don't. I hope you don't mind me saying this, but it seems I have a perception of you based on the voice that I can hear. I have a perception of that period of time, and the idea that you would be flung in that situation and having to live and work in that way. That sort of there for me. There's a bit of a tension there, but it sounds that you speak with so much joy about it.
Yes, that's right. After the life I had lived after I lost my mum, this was joyful for me because I needed companionship, you see, and I needed lots of friends, which I'd never had before after I left school. So I loved doing what I did in the army. Because, you see, though they were mixed batteries, half men and half girls, it was the girls that had to provide the men with the information they needed to fire the guns. The men couldn't have fired the guns without the ATS girls telling them where to fire, to kind of put it blunt. Because we had to work the instruments that would give us the... We had to know the aircraft in the first place. So we used to spend hours and hours of time when we weren't on duty learning all about aircraft recognition. Excuse me. And we had to stand out in the open and listen and watch. And of course, we all had good hearing and eyesight in those days. And you would see the aircraft and recognise it, and then you would set your instruments on it. I was working on the height finders, which could tell us the height and the bearing of the plane. That information was read off by the third person in my team, who made a note of the position the height finder was in. She would know exactly where the plane was. That information had to be passed to the NCO in charge of the gun, so he could tell his men which way to turn the gun round and how much to elevate the actual gun. We also had a plotting room that we had to work on underground with the large glass table and the map underneath. And it would come up, the plane would be marked on the table, and every few seconds we had to wear the earphones and mouthpiece, and every few seconds, as it moved, we had to mark with a cross on the glass top. When it went out of our radius, it was passed on to the next gun site, which was a few miles down the road or across the country, and they would pick it up as it went out of our range. We knew that we were necessary, and we knew that the boys couldn't do what they were doing. I mean, after all, there was a crew, with each gun there was a crew of men, and of course the girls could never have lifted those shells, so they were big shells. And of course they needed men to do that. The girls wouldn't have done that anyway. We were only taking the place of the men so that the men could be sent abroad.
Older
men were transferred to our battery because it was a fairly young battery in actual fact. And we'd only been formed a few months when they decided they would take all the young men out because they needed to send them abroad and replace them with older men. When I say older men, they were probably in their 30s or so, you know, but they were older to us. And they treated us, or we treated them, more like fathers when all the young boys went, you know. As I say, they were all sent abroad, and we had these older men. But, I mean, of course, they were very active and very fit, but they used to do all the heavy lifting and cleaning the guns and what have you. Yeah.
Did the men, do you recall the men appreciating what the women were contributing, or was there rivalry, was there tension?
No rivalry at all, no. They knew that we were necessary, and we knew that they were. We were just, you know, a big team. We had about four teams of 20 girls on each shift, and we had to work in shifts, you see, so that you knew when the sirens went that you were the ones that had to run, drop everything you were doing, pick up your gas mask and your steel helmet, and run to the command post, where you straight away took the covers off the instruments and started working, searching.
Were you ever frightened?
Frightened? No, No. Cold. Sometimes we were out for hours and hours, you know. Especially if you were called out in the middle of the night. But no, I wasn't frightened. No.
Were others frightened?
No, I don't think so. No.
Is that because they didn't fully appreciate the impact, or is it just that they couldn't deal with being frightened?
We wanted to shoot the enemy down. That's all we wanted to do. Shoot them down. And on one occasion when we shot one, the pilot bailed out, of course. And of course we watched him, the parachute, come down. And he was only a couple of fields away. And we were told after, I don't know what happened to him, they must have got him, but they told us after that we could go out and collect some of his, well, collect the parachute, to be short. And we were all allowed a bit of this parachute white nylon. It was lovely. Yeah.
How long did you worked doing this throughout the war, presumably?
Well, right up until 1945, because I came out in 45, the end of the war. No, it would have been late 44 then, because when they decided they didn't need the AK guns anymore, the heavy guns, they sent a friend of mine, my friend and I, to Glasgow, place called St Johnston, just outside Glasgow, and we were cleaning and working on tanks for a few months before I was actually come to Civvy Street. Yeah.
What was the move from Leicester to, or from the anti-aircraft battery to
Well, from Leicester, I went to Arborfield, where we did most of our training on the AKAC. And then, of course, the battery travelled round to different gun sites on and off all through.
I'm just wondering what the experience was like of leaving the AKAC and then going to Glasgow. You know, did you was there a sense of sort of loss or sense of sadness that you were sort of
We knew that we weren't needed anymore. That the big guns weren't going to be used anymore. Most of the fighting, I think, then was in the sky, wasn't it? But you see, we were never told any news. We were never allowed to listen to the news. We never knew what was going on in the rest of the world. Our little gun sites were our life, you see. We didn't know what was going on in the rest of the world. Nobody wanted to tell us. I mean, they said it was dangerous to talk. We were stored to secrecy anyway, and it was dangerous to talk.
I have to say, it's quite some way of galvanising a workforce to make sure that everybody is focused on one goal. I mean, that's what I'm hearing from you. That
you never spoke to civilians. You see, you didn't know any civilian to speak to, and we were always miles away from anywhere. On one occasion, we did have a gun site right out in the country, and we did have one little pub, and it was in Bounds. And I remember they used to serve their beer in 1 pound jam jars. We could only go there when we were off duty, of course. Apart from that, life went on as usual. You got up in the morning and you done your job, and if your little section of 20 girls was on duty that day, you'd be ready for call all day. In your spare time, of course, I also went on a course for physical training. I was a PTI, physical training instructor. I was the only one on the site that did physical training. All part of my dancing, I think.
At the end of the war, or shortly before the end of the war, when you left, what was that experience like? Did you feel relief? Did you feel sadness? What was it like leaving the service?
What do you mean, when I came out?
Yeah.
Oh. I missed it, but I knew I'd got to work because I had no income, you see. We didn't have a lump sum like the men had. We didn't have a suit like the men had, a demob suit. So it was really starting from scratch. And of course, I was married in 1944, the year before I came out. And I joined the, applied for a job with a GPO, as a GPO telephonist, because I was used to wearing the headsets, and I thought, well, that's all right, it's a good paying job. So I went to school for the GPO for a couple of months, and I stayed in that job as a GPO telephonist for 20 years.
When you left the service,
yes,
you had no lump sum, you had no DMOP soup,
no.
It was just the end of it.
No.
Do you? So when I hear you say that...
Well, there might have been a small amount, probably about £20 or something like that.
So when I hear you say that, you probably are not surprised to hear this, that makes me feel quite angry on your behalf. Because you sort of gave your life. I realise that you got something back in return. You had companionship, but also you contributed to the war effort.
Yes, that's true. Well, I suppose we were treated more or less like the underdogs, like we have been ever since. I mean, we always hear so much about the army, the girls in the Navy and the girls in the Air Force, but you never hear anything about the ATS girls, do you? And this is why I'm so glad this is coming up now, but they're trying to find the oldest veteran. I don't suppose it'll be me, but because there were, do you know, there were over 300,000 women in the ATS during the war. And that's a lot of women, isn't it?
It is. It is. Mm. It's almost 500,000.
That's right.
And that is a lot of
300,000. They all served in the ATS during the war.
Did you at any point after the war, when you were working in the GPO, did you ever at any point look back on the time in the war and think, actually, we should have been treated better?
No. No, not from my point of view, because I knew that I could work and I knew I was getting a well-paid job, and my husband stayed in the army a year after me, which gave me a year. I had to try and put a home together. And we had coupons then, and I had to buy our first lot of furniture on the weekly.
On the weekly,
I only had my wage coming in. You see,
on the weekly, what's the weekly?
you pay so much a week for it.
Oh, okay, so higher purchase.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
How was work and life in the GPO? What was that like in comparison?
Well, you still needed discipline, of course, and you still had quite a lot of training to do because you needed to know the codes for all over the country for doing that particular job.
So you knew the STD codes for all over the country?
Of course, yes. When I first joined, it was manual, and then it went automatic, and then it went as you say. As it is now, yeah.
Would you
but
be...
That was the days when you had to sit at a switchboard and pull up the cords and plug in, you know.
Would you be surprised to hear me say that I find that utterly amazing? I really do.
Very interesting, because I was still learning, you see, because then I could learn all over the country. I knew where different cities and towns were situated, and it was like map reading. Yeah, it's very interesting.
What did you enjoy studying at school?
Sorry?
What did you enjoy studying at school?
Practically everything, really. Especially keep fit and sports and things like that, I loved.
Were you good at maths?
Yes. Yeah, I passed. I was as good as anybody else. Yeah, reading and writing and everything, yes. And spelling, yeah, I'm as good as anybody else. My report for the army said my military conduct was very good. That's what it says on my report from the army. I'm holding it in my hand now.
Can you read it out? Is there any more of it?
No, it just gives you my number, and my rank was only a private when I was a gunner, of course, a private when I left. I stayed a private. I wasn't interested in being an NCO. That's a non-commissioned officer. It just said the date I joined and the date I left, and my conduct was very good.
What do you think, when you look back on it, what do you think army life taught you the most?
Oh, comradeship. Definitely comradeship. And discipline, of course. Yes. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. I mean, I can't say it was a lovely war. It wasn't a lovely war. We did have some frightening times. But it's always a good time you want to remember, isn't it? I can give you an instance. There was a gun site on the south coast that was firing at the, you know, at the aircraft, and they could see where there was a lot of guns all firing at the same time, you see, and they decided to dive bomb this gun site, and there were 12 of the crew were killed, ATS girls as well, of course. And I was surprised because I went to Hayling Island on a holiday last year, and there was a memorial. And I said to my carer, took me actually, and I said to her, oh, let's pull in and see what that's all about. And there were photos there of the actual crews that were on this gun site, and all the names and photos of the lads and girls that were killed. And I thought, well, wasn't I lucky that didn't happen to, you know, on our gun site? Yeah. That really taught me something. And that was only last year.
What did it teach?
It's lovely that they're still remembering.
What did it teach you, do you think?
How lucky I was. That we were out, you know, doing the same things as those girls and boys were doing. And they didn't dive bomb us. I just feel lucky that they didn't. But I would recommend anyone that's interested in what the gunners did during the war, I would recommend anyone would go and see that on the Hayling Island.
But I wonder whether there is something that you want to tell me that I haven't asked you.
Oh, gosh. No, I don't think so.
It's not a trick question. I
mean,
always want to just check.
You've got to speak to lots of other people. are they also in the ATS?
I believe so, yes. There are, yeah. I think there might be 6 other people that I'm speaking to.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. And they'll all be around my age?
Yes, some are. Some aren't quite as young as you. There
I'm
we are.
A bit older than me. Yeah, well, that's okay. I didn't think I was the oldest anyway.
Yeah, and it's not a competition, Grace. It's not a competition. What do you think, as a result of this conversation, how about this? As a result of this conversation...
You've been so helpful. You really have. I was really nervous about speaking to someone I'd never met. But you have made it very easy for me, dear.
Bless you. I want you to keep safe, and I want you to keep hanging out the washing.
Yeah. Oh, no, the next thing will be getting it in before it rains.
Right, OK, then I need you to go and get the washing before it rains, because I think it's going to rain.
I will do that.
Thank you very much for your time.
And I'll make a nice cup of tea.
Excellent, excellent. You've been listening to Women Who Serve, a podcast series that spotlights, celebrates and honours the pioneering women who have served and are serving in the Army. It was a thoroughly good production for the Women's Royal Army Corps Association.